everyone. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. Don't worry, Neil, I'm nervous too. So, anyway, my sobriety date is December 24th of 2001. My home group is the Tuesday Night Step Group in Seminole. I'm also pretty much a member of the Monday Night Speakers Group in St. Petersburg. World famous Monday Night Speaker. There you go. So anyway, the reason I got to where I am is even as a child, as a youngin, my whole life has been centered around fear. I mean, it just, from as long as I can remember, I mean, I've been biting my nails since I had teeth. You know, I've been pulling my hair out. I mean, it's just a very anxious kid, very nervous, and just very fearful. And, you know, just really wasn't right as a child, you know. And I got to be honest, I've been coming to the podium. Every time I speak, I always want to say that I had a normal childhood. And I had to take a look at that. And I realized that I did not have a normal childhood. I thought because I had two parents, that, you know, things were normal. And because I played baseball, things were normal. But things weren't normal. By the time I was in the third grade, I was already skipping school. And the reason we would skip school is so we could sit in the woods and throw things at cars. And I mean, that would be the sole purpose of us not going to school. And it was crazy. And that came to an abrupt end as I discovered I had tomatoes one day and I hit a guy in a van in the face and about flipped his van over. And that was the hardest I've ever ran in my life. We ran into parts of the woods that we didn't know existed. And we kind of put an end to that. And my father had left the year later. And that's when a lot of trouble started happening for me at school. And the reason he left is, you know, he was a drinker. And he was a binge drinker, and that's what I was. And I noticed when he was home, I didn't really put this together until I got sober, but he had a lot of anger when he was at home. You know, he wasn't a violent guy. He didn't beat me. I mean, he'd give me one every now and then, but it wasn't anything out of hand. It was probably because I deserved it. But I just noticed he was really angry, and what I figured out is because he just did not know how to deal with his alcoholism. You know, when he wasn't drinking, he wasn't happy. And that's kind of, you know, he wasn't very faithful, so that's why he left. And we lived in North Carolina at the time. I lived in Charlotte, and he moved down here to be a vacuum salesman, door-to-door. And he was a very good golfer, and he played a lot of golf and made a lot of friends doing it. And he would, if he had a good, I always knew when he had a good game because you wouldn't see him for a while. And it was crazy. It was a crazy lifestyle. But when he moved here, that's when I got out of control for me at school. I became very defiant, very angry, and really started acting out. And I ended up striking my teacher in the fourth grade. And I got in a lot of trouble for that. Called her some names I shouldn't have. And it just, I wasn't a very good kid. And I like to think I was. I like to think that I was a good kid and, you know, I had everything together. But I was not a good kid at all. And even in baseball, you know, if I would screw up in baseball or I thought the ump made a bad call, I would let him know, and I would let him know with some words that a little kid should not be saying. And, you know, I would kick dirt. I was like one of the coaches out there, you know, spitting and kicking dirt. And, it would, you know, a couple times I was actually told you would have made All-Stars if your attitude would have been better. But it just wasn't going to happen. I was just an angry kid. So my dad had to come home after that incident with the teacher. He had to come back here and deal with me. So I kind of cooled my jets for a little bit. And the next year, they stuck me in a class with a teacher who was pretty hardcore, and she wasn't going to put up with any BS. So I kind of mellowed out and did some schoolwork for once, and it was an okay year. And then the next year, the sixth grade, it started all over again. And we lived in a neighborhood. It was a bunch of mothers raising their kids, and all the mothers worked. There were no dads around. There were about 15 or 20 of us. Running around a neighborhood with whatever we wanted to do, we could do. We had no curfews. We did what we wanted to. And we were a bunch of little punks. And so we started a little theft ring at the local convenience store. You know, but in Charlotte, you got to wear these big jackets in the winter. So we'd put on these jackets and stuff a bunch of candy in it and take it to school and make, you know, $15, which, you know, to a sixth grader, that's a lot of money. So, but anyway, we ended up getting caught for that. So that ended our little reign of theft. And So we decided one day we're gonna raid a liquor cabinet, and that's when it all started. And unfortunately, we raided my mom's liquor cabinet first, and you know, parents are stupid. They don't know what's going on. So we figured we could drink all the liquor, pour water back in the bottles, and everything will be fine. But we didn't know we got our hands on. And it wasn't like we decided we're going to make some frozen drinks with a little umbrellas, you know, some rum runners here, some shooters here. No, we were finding a big old 7-Eleven cup and putting anything we could get our hands on in this cup and started downing it. And we didn't know we had some Bacardi 151 in there. And so my friend was a little crazier than me, and he decided, I took one sip and about gagged. And he took that thing and he polished off a lot of liquor. I mean, too much, obviously, because he ended up getting rushed to the hospital, had to get his stomach pumped out. And, you know, I witnessed this whole thing. There's like five of us. We all witnessed this going on. And you think that might have scared us away from alcohol for a little bit, but I don't know what it was, because I hated the taste. I didn't get a buzz from it. You know, and you got to, I left out the part that I'm still that fearful little kid. You know, I'm the run of the litter. I'm picked on. You know, I'm gonna do what all the other kids are doing. You know, from the time my dad left, I was a follower, and whatever the other kids were gonna do, that's what I was gonna do. And that's why I stopped playing sports, because my friend said only jocks play sports. If you want to be cool and hang out with us, you can't play sports anymore. And that was enough for me to quit. So, you know, I hated the taste of alcohol. And my friend's going to the hospital, but something, I don't know what it was just something for us to do. So we just perceived. And the next time I drank, I felt it. You know, we toned it down a little bit, and I took about three shots, and I got a buzz. And I had that feeling we all hear about in here. You know, my fear went away. I just felt good, you know. And it was different. And all hell broke loose after that. You know, the whole neighborhood just started going downhill. And I have three friends going to juvenile detention, three friends going to treatment. And my mother always thought the other kids were the problem. And part of that was my doing. You know, I could manipulate and tell her what she wanted to hear. And, you know, it was early stages of alcoholism. And one of those things is being a king BSer, you know, and I was good at it. So I could just convince her that all the other kids are doing it. But in reality, I was as much of a problem, if not more, than all the other kids. I've just been lucky so far. I haven't been really caught for anything. But she freaked out, and she moved me to Jacksonville, Florida, with my now stepfather and herself. And when we got there, a lot of resentment, because I'm a fearful little kid, and I got to start all over. I was in my comfort zone back there. And now I got to start all over. And when I got there, it turned from 20 kids hanging out to about 50. And it was a lot heavier. Actually, alcohol is probably one of the hardest things I could get my hands on. So we were just getting crazy. And I'll just leave all that stuff out. But you can imagine it was some pretty hard substances going around. And so I fit right in, because I'd already been partying and just doing my thing. And so what had happened was, one day I come home from school, and I'm oblivious to what parents know or think, and I'm just a dumb kid. I mean, I was on the second story, and my mother's room was down below, and I cut out a little square in my screen so I could throw cigarette butts out there and smoke at night, and I'm smoking out the window like she's not going to know, not even thinking that there's a big pile of cigarette butts sitting right outside our window. And, you know, parents are dumb. What do they know? So anyway, I come home from school, and there's some nice plants I had growing in my room sitting on the kitchen table. And, so they were, anyway. So my mom says, would you like to explain these to me? And I just immediately, I said, okay, yeah, they're for a science project at school. And so she knew I was completely full of you-know-what after that. And I basically, after that little answer I gave her, I had my own little private investigator. So every time I'm coming home, drunk, high, whatever, she's on me. And it got old real quick. And she freaked out, because this is 3, 4, 5 nights a week. And, I mean, anytime I had free time to go do something, that's what I'm doing. You know, it didn't matter what it was. You know, it could have been liquor. It could have been anything else. And really what it was about is changing the way I felt about myself. You know, that's what it was. And it just, that's all it was. I just did not like me for who I was at that young age. And I had all that going on, all that fear. And when I partied, I felt like I got respect from people. You know, like, wow, that kid's good, man. He can throw down. And I thrived on that, man. That's how I felt good. And anyway, so Jacksonville got old. And it was the same story, getting out of hand, getting in trouble. And she decided it's time for me to move down here to live with my father. And so I moved here in the summer of 85. And when I got here, right before I left, my mother took me to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina for a week just to kind of say goodbye. She was moving to Pennsylvania. And when I got there, we stayed in this condominium. And two doors down were a bunch of seniors in high school. And they were there for getting out of school, and they were, they were partying down. And they gave me a beer funnel. I walked over there, and I was making sure I was going to get to that party, whether my mother liked it or not. But they gave me a beer funnel, and they put a beer in it, and I put that thing to my lips, and I got a whole room full of 18-year-olds sitting there looking at me, and I'm 14, and I put that thing down in 2 seconds flat, and I had that whole room just cheering me on, going, yeah! And that was my moment. I mean, I had arrived, you know? And that was, I felt so good about that. When I got to St. Pete, I knew. I'm like, this is who I'm going to be. I'm going to be the power drinker, you know? And that's who I was. My sister already lived here. She had a bunch of friends. She was a little older, so I just started going to parties with her, and I fit right in. I could drink with the best of them or outdrink them, and that was my goal. You know, I thought that's how you became friends with people. I thought that's how I could build relationships. I thought that's how I could get respect. And, you know, I'd get to these parties, and I'd race people, funneling beers, shotgunning beers. You know, I could shoot a quarter in a cup, you know, 10 feet across the table in a glass this big. And, you know, I loved it. And, that's what I like doing. And, you know, if you wanted to go study, I really wasn't your guy. But if you wanted to go drink, you know, you could call me and I would drop whatever I was doing, which was probably drinking anyway, and go drink. And that was my MO in school. You know, I was that guy. I was the party guy. I hung around a lot of people. And let me tell you, high school was a lot of work. It was because I had this image to uphold. You know, everything was a charade with me. You know, I wanted to be the guy who could outdrink everybody in the school, but yet I don't want anyone to know how much I really drink. You know, I don't want anyone to know that there might be a problem with alcohol there. You know, I couldn't do that. And I remember I got my first report card, and I had done maybe 30 minutes of schoolwork in 1 6-week period. And, you know, it was straight F's. And my dad saw it, and he's like, he wasn't even mad. He's just like, okay, you know, what are we going to do with this? And he just told me flat out. He's like, son, you either get better grades or you're going to have to quit school and get a job and start, you know, do something with yourself. Well, this is not going to happen. And honestly, I was having too much fun, way too much fun to quit school, too many people, too many parties. So my great ambitions to get just straight D's and keep it moving forward, you know. And that's what I proceeded to do. And that's kind of the way I was through my life. Just do enough to get by, keep people off my back, don't let people in, don't let people know how much of a problem there might be, and just keep moving forward, keep the ball rolling. And, you know, I was a DC student, and everything I was doing was calculated. You know, I was a nice guy in school. I never got in trouble for one reason, because I knew if it came between a D or an F, if I was a nice guy, the teacher might just let me go with a D. You know, and I just made sure I never got in trouble in school. And I didn't want to be the troublemaker, because I didn't want people really to, I didn't want to let anybody in. You know, I just had this delusional image I had to uphold. You know, but I wasn't BSing anybody. Everybody knew what was going on. And I didn't care, because in my own head, I was fooling everybody. And that's all that mattered. And so nothing changed in school. You know, I surfed a lot and chased a lot of girls and had a lot of fun. And, you know, it wasn't a complete waste. And my grandmother had moved in with us when I was 17. And this is probably the only noble thing I did as a teenager. And I take that back. I did it because God made me do it. But she was completely senile. She should have been in a nursing home. But my father was not capable of putting that together financially, emotionally, physically. He just he basically pawned her off on me. And I took care of her for about a year. And basically, I had to take care of her in full detail. So, but you know, I look back and I'm grateful I did that, because the early stages of her Alzheimer's, I took advantage of that. And, you know, I started stealing her money because I knew I'd get away with it. And I look back on that, and I still got to make an amends one day, but I try to make an amends by thinking maybe me taking care of her might have, maybe that's why God put her in my life like that, because I was stealing from her. I don't know, but it's not one of my prouder moments, because again, I don't want to think to myself that I'm that guy, you know, that I'm a thief. You know, I don't want to think that I'm that guy, because I'm a nice guy, but yeah, a little money's not going to hurt anything, but yeah, it's stealing, you know, and that's what I did. And so, you know, for me to say that's noble was, I forget I even said that, because it wasn't noble. It's just something I had to do, and I was grateful. And, you know, I watched her pass, and it was a good life lesson for me. And I learned a lot. You know, I learned a lot about my father and some other things. And it was but I was glad to see her pass away. So I never really accumulated enough credits to get out of school, and life just went on. All my friends were graduating, doing their thing, military, college, whatever, and I just moved on to the street. And I bounced around a lot of houses. And basically, if I knew you were having a party, I'd immediately find out how long your parents were leaving for, so I could just kind of settle my way in and, you know, be the life of the party, and then find out and kind of just stay there. And then when they're ready to come back, you know, time for me to move on, and I would scoot to somebody else's house. And I would sleep on couches, and it was crazy. And the thing about this behavior is I just didn't see anything wrong with it. You know, it was, if somebody would get on me about it, I'm like, see, man, that guy's just being a dick. You know, and it's just, it was always the other person's fault, because I never want to take a look at myself. I was just always the victim. So, you know, I'd sleep on couches, and people would start saying, you know, how do you manage to go out drinking all the time, but you can't get your act together to get a job or anything? And then once people would say that, it was time for me to go. It was time for me to move on and go to the next place and start taking from them. And it was a crazy lifestyle. And like I said, I just didn't see anything wrong with this. And I found out when we're in this disease, whatever we're doing, we're good with it. You know, whether we're sleeping under a bridge, sleeping on someone's couches, you know, if we are knee-deep in this disease, we become okay with that, wherever we are. And that's just the delusion that we get put in from alcoholism. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful, you know, and it says it in the book, and it's so true. So I just kept going like that. And for the next 2 years, I'd work my mother to send me some money every now and then. And I had 3 or 4 guys I hung out with who were just like me. And we lived one day at a time, man. We would scrounge up enough money for 2 cases of beer, some cigarettes, find some girls dumb enough to hang out with us, and we were set for a day, and we did that one day at a time. And, you know, it got exhausting after a while. So after a couple years, I got a job, and it was with my dad's friend. He was a general manager, so I immediately knew I could just do what I wanted at that place. So I'd come in drunk, not come in at all, come in late, and just take an advantage, because I knew I could. And it was just wrong, you know, but it was okay to me, because I'm a drunk and I'm an alcoholic, and whatever I'm doing is fine, because, you know, I'm just very self-centered at this point. And I lasted 2 years at that job, and I was on my way out. They'd had enough of me, and I went to Daytona for spring break, and I met some people there, and they were with a girlfriend of mine, and they were, these guys looked like they had a lot of money. And so I started partying with them, and they told me I need to come work for them when we get back to St. Pete. So I went to work for these guys, and the reason I went to work for them, it wasn't my impressive resume, is because I had things, and I could bring it to work. And But lo and behold, that's when it all kind of shifted gears, and the drinking, it got to the point I'm just doing it from, I go out Monday night and get to the bar after work, and they call it happy hour. I mean, if I could sit there an hour and drink and go home, I'd be happy too, but it just never worked out that way. You know, for me, my grand plan was to get there, drink a couple pitchers, do some eat some chicken wings or something, play a game of darts, and be home by 10. But, you know, reality is I get there, I drink a beer, then I start doing Jello shots, you know, double Captain and Cokes, whatever it is, just pounding the liquor, just getting drunk off my butt. And then I'm off to the races till the next morning. And I go right into work with no sleep. And by 7:30, I'm down in a bottle of Captain Morgan's just to get my heart rate down to make it into work. And it was a crazy, crazy lifestyle. And I did this, and I would sleep it off the next night and do it again the next day, and just kept repeating it over and over again. By the weekends, you know, I just stay up for 2 and 3 days at a time, and just didn't see anything wrong with it. Nothing, you know. And it was just a very, very physically abusing lifestyle, and just crazy. And I look back on it, and I just, I'm, by God's grace, I'm still here, you know, by God's grace. So I kind of did that pattern for the next 8 years of my life, and then I met this girl, Michelle. And when I met Michelle, I thought for sure she's going to be the one who's going to change me. You know, I thought, wow, this is going to be the one, you know. But I remember our first date, you know. First date we go on, I'm nervous because I told myself, okay, tonight just do it differently. Why don't you just go out and be a normal human being and not drink? So I'm sitting there pacing. I'm like, okay, you know, I won't drink tonight. I'll just go out and have fun, and we'll try something new and different. So I pick her up, and we go to this restaurant, and they're like, well, you're supposed to have a reservation. However, you can go sit at the bar. So a big light bulb goes off in my head, and she I was waiting to see what she said. I didn't want to say I was going to sit at the bar because I didn't, you know, I don't want her to think I want to drink or anything. That's not like me. So anyway, she says, yeah, we can go sit at the bar. So after that, I just tuned out. And we're walking to the back, and she's talking, and I'm not hearing a word she's saying. All that's going in my head is she going to drink? 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 And I'm just tunnel vision to that bar, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at the menu, and I'm pretending like I'm looking at what's on there, like I'm going to order food. And I don't even know what's on that menu. I'm just like, is she going to drink? What's she going to get? So the bartender comes over. He's like, can I help y'all? And I'm just looking. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm looking at the menu, whatever. And she gets a cranberry and vodka. And I'm like, yes. So I get a double screwdriver, and it was on. You know, we just started partying down. And I ended up at a club downtown. And, you know, I took some things I shouldn't have taken. And ended up taking my clothes off at the bar. And, you know. So we get home that night, and I don't know what happened, but I do know this. I woke up the next morning, and she's laying next to me, and I had peed all over the bed. And so she gets up, and, you know, there's no hiding it. I mean, it's hot in here. I'm sweating. No. But so anyway, she gets up, and I'm like, yeah, I'll see you later. And I put my head down, and I shook my head. I'm like, you went from not drinking to probably the most humiliating night of your life, you know. But that's what alcohol does to us. You know, that's step one right there, you know. And so anyway, I wrote that off. I'm like, well, that was just a good girl but a bad date. And but anyway, she called me 2 nights later and wanted to go out again. I'm like, this one's a keeper. So, yeah. So we started dating, and, you know, I thought for sure she's going to change me. You know, I'm like, this is the one. All my hopes and dreams are right here. You know, I'm going to change my way I do things. I'm going to put that drink down, but nothing changed. I just brought her into my world. You know, she's from Arcadia, Florida. The pace down there is a lot slower than here. So, you know, she goes from just being a normal, you know, go out till midnight type till staying up for 2 and 3 days at a time, and it got old quick. It got real old, and she basically, our grand idea was for her to get pregnant. So we tried for 3 months, and successfully I got her pregnant, and I think what she was thinking is that would be the thing that would change me. And then that's damn sure what I thought. You know, okay, well, the girl didn't change it, but a baby, yeah, a baby, that'll really make me put down the drink. So I didn't put down the drink. And now I got a pregnant girlfriend, and I'm not very pregnant friendly. And, you know, now I'm going for cigarettes Friday night, and, you know, I'm leaving out the park. I'll see you Sunday morning. And, you know, I wasn't a nice guy. And the crazy part about that is, in my own head, I was really going to go to the store and buy cigarettes, stop by a friend's for a beer, stop by the bar for a beer, and just be home in like an hour. That way I can take a little heat, but she'll get over it in time. And that's really what I thought I was going to do. But I'm an alcoholic. I pick up beer, I'm gone. And that's what I would do. And the crazy part about it is I was so delusional that I thought if I got home Sunday morning about 5 a.m., about an hour before she'd get up, I could tiptoe in the house and run and jump on the couch and just act like I've been asleep for like 8 hours, you know, not knowing I smell like a brewery, I smell like cigarettes and God knows what else. And then she would come in and I'd be like, what, pretend like I've been asleep. And, you know, it just crazy. But one day I pulled that and I came home and she's gone. She's out to here, and I came in and all her stuff's packed. She has nowhere to go. I don't even know where she went. She doesn't have any family here. She doesn't really have anyone here. And my first thought was, cool, man, I just bought myself another hall pass to go back out again. And that's what I proceeded to do, but I couldn't get a hold of anybody. And so I laid on the couch, and I passed out. And I woke up about 6 hours later, and, you know, I knew. I'm like, okay, that was probably one of the most vulnerable moments I've ever had. And, you know, I wanted to quit. I wanted to stop numerous times. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people in here can relate to the three-day binges. When you're done with a three-day binge, you never say to yourself, boy, that was fun. We got to do that again sometime. You know, it's always like, oh, man, I did it again, you know. And that's what happened. And, you know, I knew something had to change. So I think that's really when God stepped in for me, because I fell back asleep. And I think if I wouldn't have got that call from my mom, my dad, my sister, I think I probably would have gone back out again. And I don't know if I'd be here today. But that call I got was what it took, because I was at a moment of vulnerability, and I actually had my ears open for once in my life. And they just want to know what was going on. So I decided I'd go into a treatment center. And I went into a treatment center. I really went in just to quiet everyone down. You know, I don't know if I had intentions of really stopping. I didn't know anything about it. You know, I tried on my own. I just didn't know. But I figured this would be the best way just to get back in everyone's good graces and quiet down the storm of 15 minutes left? Okay. So anyway, this treatment center, by God's grace, I picked it, and it was based off the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't do it for that reason. I did it because of work with my insurance. But I'm very grateful that I did, because, you know, I learned a lot in there. And I learned what they told me flat out. It's like, the way you do it, the way you roll, if you don't get some sort of recovery in your life, you will be back out there in a matter of time. And I'm in a treatment center over the holidays. And it just and they told me, like, normal people that don't have problems with alcohol, they don't end up in places like this, especially at Christmas time. I mean, come on. So I listened, and this treatment center, I don't know how they are now, but this treatment center, I'm forever grateful, because they wanted to know what the hell I was doing the day I got out. They didn't want it. They just weren't saying, okay, good job, David, you're on your happy way. No, they wanted to know what I was doing. And I was going to a meeting, and they wanted to make sure I knew what meeting I was going to and what time. And they wanted me to have a plan. And that's what they told me I need to do if I want to stay sober. And, you know, if you're new in here, man, that's important. Because if I wouldn't have had a plan, I probably would have just gone to my boy's house and would have just started the whole cycle over again. So anyway, I got my first 5 months of sobriety were easy. They weren't hard at all. You know, I was 270 pounds. I was losing weight. I was just riding that pink cloud they talk about in here. And just life was grand. And, you know, my idea of Alcoholics Anonymous was this 5:30 meeting. And it was a bunch of, the average age was probably 50. And I just didn't know. You know, I thought that's what AA was. And so somebody suggested I go to a young people's group. And I went to the Pinellas Park Young People's Group. And I was in awe. I couldn't believe it. It wasn't anything like this, but it was about half the people. But I just could not believe how many kids were actually getting sober. And it was what I needed. And that's where I met my sponsor. And my sponsor, he really showed me how to do this program. And boy, he was a nice guy. He was a nice guy before he started sponsoring me. You know, he reeled me in. And, you know, I got him to be my sponsor. And, you know, I remember the first time, he comes up, and this is the first day we met, and he was actually my sponsor. He's like, how you doing? I'm like, oh, man, I'm doing good. He's like, mm-mm, I don't want to hear that anymore. He said, I don't want to hear how good you're doing. I want to hear how shitty you're doing, how bad you're doing. You know, that's what he wanted to know. He wanted to know the truth. And I had to start listening. And, man, he would lay into me about things that at the time I thought were really, really just kind of juvenile. But, you know, and I would go home. I'm like, man, I'm firing that guy. You know, and I'd do that every time I'd see him. And, you know, he never knew. I mean, I couldn't tell him I was going to fire him. But, you know, I remember when I had 6 months and he told me, I want you to go get a chip at every meeting you go to this week. I'm like, I can do that. Even if I had no intentions of doing it, I'd still tell him, yeah, to avoid the confrontation. So I go and the third meeting, I don't get a chip. And he says, well, why didn't you go get that? I'm like, well, I already got two this week. I don't need to get a third one. And he's like, see, you know, that chip is not about you. It's about the new guy who's here, the new girl who can't relate to the guy who's got 9 years sobriety. But, you know, he can see a guy getting 6 months and might be like, wow, you know, that's something I can relate to. You know, and that was a big learning lesson for me that, you know, it's really not about me anymore. It's about, you know, trying to help the new guy, help the new people, and let them know that we're here, we're available, and we're you know, we're willing to help. And I remember, man, I just didn't know about the sponsorship thing. I just didn't understand it. I didn't understand how somebody would be willing to help me like that for free. And you know what I realized is that's how we stay sober. Is we stay sober by helping the newcomer. And you know, for me, It's been a wild ride. It really has. I've been up and down with this thing. I've never been perfect, not even close to being perfect. My fourth year of sobriety, I thought I owed it to myself to be sober, damn it, and I don't need to do any work anymore. You know, I thought I had arrived and the magic pill would come in and I'd take it and I'm just sober now and I don't need to do this anymore. And I joined another group, talked to my sponsor 4 times that year, went to a beginner's meeting the whole time. It's what I like to call David Anonymous, you know? And I did that for about a year. And I have to admit, I wasn't praying. I wasn't doing anything. And after that year, I was stark raven sober. I was ready to do something. I was going to drink off myself or whatever it was going to be, but it was going to be something drastic because I just could not handle it anymore because I just didn't have any coping skills anymore. I've been doing it my way. With no help, no sponsorship, no sponsees, no nothing for a year. And it showed. And sometimes that's what we got to go through to get where we are. We're humans, man. We got to go through the act of desperation. We got to go through the pain to take steps forward. And, you know, I'm very grateful to have this program in my life. Today, Michelle and I, we had the boy, Spencer. He's 9 now. We got another kid, Ian. We're happily married. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, It's saved my marriage for the reason that the woman I married basically married a newcomer, and we didn't know each other. I mean, we knew how to party together. We knew how to argue. She knew how to yell at me for staying out for 2 and 3 days, but all of a sudden I'm sober, and we got a kid, and it was an eye-opener. It was an experience. But through you people, you know, through the help of everyone, I mean, I learned how to deal with it. I learned how to be a better father. I learned how to be a better husband. And, you know, today we have a good relationship. And one of the reasons I think we have a good relationship is we both know that we both have the tools to learn how to admit when we're wrong, we can admit it to each other. You know, if my wife's got a problem with me, when I was out there, I mean, what do you mean? But now it's like, okay, you know, I need to work on that. And I'm not just saying that so she'll be quiet. I'm actually saying, okay, I probably need to work on that. And that's what we do, and that's how we build our relationship. And, you know, my children, they're a true blessing. You know, don't get me wrong. It's two boys, 6 and 9 years old. I mean, you know, we wanted 3 kids till we had 2. And, yeah. And you know, I heard this in a movie once, but it's so true. I feel like, you know, one I'm going to put through college, the other I'm going to put through a wall. You know? But you know what, man? The kids are, they're a real blessing. And you know, I can remember Spencer before Ian was born. I would come home from work, and, you know, he would just come darting across the room and just give me a big hug around my legs and say, Daddy! You know, and I didn't even realize what was happening until I heard somebody at a speaker meeting, say that their kid does that and what a blessing that is. And I heard that. I'm like, my kid's been doing that since he could walk, you know. But sometimes, you know, we got to listen to other people in here to find out the miracles that are happening in our lives. And this program is nothing but miracles. You know, I know a guy, we had a year sobriety, and we went to get our badges to take meetings into jail. And we got to get our arrest records. So we go down to the sheriff's office to get them. And I've known this guy for a while. Super nice guy, mellow, laid back. And I get mine. It's got 4 things on there for alcohol-related incidents. And his is, it's a lot. It's a lot of stuff. And a lot of things that normally people would be in prison for a long time for. And I looked at that thing, and that's when I knew that AA was not just about putting down the drink, but it was really about changing people's lives. Because some of the stuff that was on this sheet, I really did not ever think this guy could be capable of doing. And, you know, because he was such a changed person. And that was really the first miracle I saw in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's, you know, the miracles are all around. And we just, we just got to look for them, you know. And we all have spiritual awakenings in different ways. And, you know, for me, I've been blessed to have good sponsorship and good fellowship and a good service sponsor. And, you know, today, Alcoholics Anonymous really, it's just changed my life. You know, it really has. But I'm not cured from this thing. You know, I was doing some things last year, a couple years before that, that I should not have been doing. Practicing these principles in most of my affairs. And I might have consequences one day. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But my sponsor said a lot of good's going to come out of that. A lot of good's going to come from this little incident. And it did. You know, it brought me back to this program. And it brought me back to the point where I knew this is the only thing that's going to help me, is by helping other people. And for the life of me, I could never realize why I had so much sobriety, but no one ever asked me to sponsor him. I could never figure it out. You know, what's wrong with me? But the moment I came back and had a new attitude about Alcoholics Anonymous and realized that this program is what's going to save my butt, I've had 3 people ask me to sponsor them in the last year, you know, in the last probably 9 months. So it's really been a blessing. And, you know, they say when the teacher's ready, the students will come. And this time I've sponsored people in the past, and I've really just never put too much of an effort into it. You know, I've kind of hidden service work. But now, I mean, I help my sponsees. I make sure they call me. I call them back. And, I mean, we all have a good relationship today. And when you have a good relationship in here, you're going to have a good relationship everywhere else in your life. You know, and you spirituality is very important in here. I mean, that year that I didn't do any praying or anything, that's the end result, man. I'm ready to just fall off a cliff. So for me, I got to get on my knees and pray in the morning and ask for help. And at the end of the night, man, I go into bed with my kids, and we get on our knees. And sometimes, man, I'm ready to pull my hair out and just flip my lid because they're just driving me up the wall. And, I mean, it gets to the point where I'm like, okay, now let's pray, you know. But, you know, we do it. And all we do, we don't make it some grand prayer. But we pray for the things we're thankful for. You know, each other, our family, our friends, my sobriety. And when you have your 6-year-old kid stop you in mid-prayer and say, and God, thank you for Daddy's sobriety. I mean, that's pretty powerful stuff. You know, and that's when my kid said that to me, and And that's when I realized that that's why I'm doing all this, is to make me a better person, make me a better father, make me a better human being. So, if you're new in here and you got a sponsor, just follow some suggestions, because they're not out to get you. They're out to save your butt. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Stan, an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this was with the feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I've been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand that love is, and we understand that service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never forget the degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.